They were just
my condolences. My condolences.
It was actually a fine of art from
I understand that. What a coincidence.
We're going to be talking about the audit committee and its role, and Scott Levy is going to be the moderator for this discussion. Scott is the managing partner for the New England region of Grant Thornton. I was doing some research on Grant Thornton. They won the award from the American Society of Training and Development as best award winner. Business Week awarded them best place to launch a career. Working Mother may name one of the 100 best companies to work for. Best internship program from Business Week. Very, very impressive group. Grant Thornton is a global organization with, 2,500 partners? 2,600 partners in 100 countries.
Yeah.
Scott has more than 20 years' experience advising clients. His current and past clients include Cognex, Nathan's Famous, my favorite hot dog, Einstein Bagels, my favorite bagels. He was assistant managing partner of the New York cluster. Does that go well with peanut butter? He was ranked by Crain's New York Business as one of the 40 under 40. Scott serves on the board of the Massachusetts Society of CPAs and also the Junior Achievement. And you're with me on the CICL board. And he received his BS in accounting from the State University of New York at Albany.
I taught him nothing but the best.
There we go.
And as I was sitting down, he gave me managing a career in tough times. So I was asking, is there something that I don't know about myself yet that I should be looking for? So just a background for myself. I actually moved up to Boston about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago. I started off at the Big Eight, then went to Grant Thornton and worked in the New York office from 96 through 2007. Did different roles, ran the audit practice, ran the New Jersey office and the audit practice, was a system managing partner. And this position opened up, and they asked me would I take it, and my first response to the managing partner in New York was, when are you retiring? And his response was, not for at least 10 years, and I said, Boston, here I come. And so, and it's actually been very nice, and I really look forward. It's been very enjoyable. It's a really nice place to live, and we bought a summer place and all this other stuff, so the people from New York aren't expecting me to come back anymore. Right. So that's just a little background about myself. So what I really wanted
to...
So I'll start off, I'm a Celtic fan. I am a Yankee fan. Actually, up until last night, I was a Cowboy fan. I'll still be a Cowboy fan, but I'm a Yankee fan. Nothing I can. My son, who when we moved here, he was 11 at that point. So I tried telling him he should be a Red Sox fan. So forgetting what I am, he's going to go to school here that he really needs to. So and my father kept on pushing the Yankees on him, and I said, Dad, you have to stop that. So in his room, and he doesn't fully understand this, he has the Red Sox and the Yankees next to each other. And I said, that really doesn't work, and he doesn't fully understand. He doesn't fully understand it, but he says he likes both. So I'm sure kids at school look at him like he's nuts when he says that, but what can you do? So, yes, I am a Yankee fan. So it wasn't good for the Yankees this week, and it wasn't good for my Cowboys this week. So from a sports perspective, it was not a good week for me. So I've been a partner for about 12 years at this point, and so I've been involved with audit committees, pre-SOX, post-SOX, good audit committees, bad audit committees, and there's all sorts of perspectives of it, and so I really wanted this to be more of a dialogue and a discussion of some of the issues that are out there, but if not, I have plenty of things I can go over which can bore you to death, so I'd rather have it as an open discussion. But just to give you a perspective, when I go to training, they send us to Chicago, and they say what they show you what it should look like and what it shouldn't look like. So I'll give you an example of what bad audit committee effectiveness was, and this is absolutely a true story for a client I had in New York. If you're subject to SOX, obviously you have to do all the SOX testing and stuff, and June 30th is the determination date of whether you have to do all the internal control testing. So my client, June 30th, they were right on the border, and then June 30th it came and they became subject to SOX. So the CFO comes in to me a couple of days later, and I said, you know, we've discussed this before, we need to start thinking about how you're going to do this, and so he looked at me and he said, we've decided not to implement it. And I said, I didn't realize it was an option. I said, it's the SEC's requirement, so I don't fully understand that. So I said, have you spoken to your audit committee about this? And they said, and he said, our audit committee is the one that recommended we don't implement it. So I said, well, I really do need to speak to the audit committee then, because this is not proper governance. And they said, well, what are the ramifications of this? So I said, well, the ramifications are within 24 hours, we will resign as the auditors. And I said, the reason why it will take me 24 hours is I got to go through a protocol to resign. So otherwise, it would be effective immediately. So then I met with the audit committee, and they said, we think this is garbage, and we don't understand why the SEC is making us do this. So I said, you could disagree all you want, I said, but the fact is, you have to implement this. So it was very tough on them to accept this. So then we went through, and it was a tough thing, and I gave them tough feedback on the CFO that he really wasn't working, doing the stuff he needed to, and he wasn't really at the level they need him to be at. So they sat me down and they said, we need for you to tell them that. So I said, I'm not management. I said, I'm the outside auditor. I said, I've given you some issues you need to deal with. They said, but you're in a better position than us to tell them that. And so I said, I can't do that. So you look at that example of governance, and that's not very good governance. So that's bad governance. Then I'll give you an example of someone that was good governance, which was a company recently did have some issues where they did come out. There was some promotions that were happening within the company. Then there were allegations that came out about some of the promotion issues and some of the issues surrounding that promotion and the allegations that came out, and there was potential of fraud and all this other stuff. And the audit committee, within hours, was all over this, hired outside counsel, did the investigations, actually terminated the CEO, did not promote the person who was supposed to be promoted, and took all the actions that they needed to. And those are tough decisions, because you're terminating key people and not promoting the people who really thought they were ready to be promoted. They took the tough decisions, they made the tough decisions, and just complete different approaches on how to deal with stuff. So those are just two extreme examples of some of the stuff I've seen, and obviously I've seen everything in between. So, you know, I have my view as an auditor of what goes on at the meetings, and I will tell you some of them are very thought-provoking, they ask some great questions, and others it's not as thought-provoking, and they're just there just because they have to meet. So what I wanted to do is go around and just ask people, so what are the issues that you're seeing out there from a governance perspective and from an audit committee perspective? So, I mean, I'll open it up, and whether you're on the audit committee or have seen them from a legal perspective or just dealing with them, any thoughts on some of the top areas that you're seeing as issues? I have my list.
You know, on some of the audit committees that I see, and often they're younger companies and they don't always have some experienced people, but a lot of directors really don't even know what questions to ask. They remind me of when I was in physics class, and there's just no way I could even ask a question because I had no idea what the guy was talking about. But sometimes, I think they're in that position. I mean, I think, you know, they are responsible for governance, but they really don't know what that means. So, if there is somebody, is there a place people can go to get training for this kind of thing?
So, first of all, there are a couple of companies that do facilitate that. We actually, we would be more than happy to do that. If we think we can get a crowd, I'll be more than happy to do a facilitation of what are some of the things the Minority Committee should be doing. And it is an issue because people get on the Audit Committee, and I just saw this happen recently with a company, which was, we need an Audit Committee member, and they go around the room, who wants to be on the Audit Committee? And then when no one raises their hand, they're saying, okay, you. And really, they don't have the expertise. Hopefully you have at least one what they call a financial expert, and hopefully that person at least will be the one to at least start taking charge and making sure the issues are addressed. But it is a serious issue because sometimes as auditors, so I'll give you from my perspective, we're begging to have people ask us some of the tough questions because the auditors are in a tough predicament because we're paid by management, appointed by the audit committee. So you have to serve both, and it's a tough balance. So if you just come straight out of the audit committee and say, management is terrible, what's the next thing management's going to do? We recommend we go with another auditor. And then if you go to if you don't tell the audit committee is saying, why didn't you tell me this? So you need sometimes, especially in those private sessions, those are the times. So for example, my client, where I told them about the CFO issues, I did that in private session. And they went right back to him and said, here's what Scott said about you. but it is important for them to understand from a financial perspective, there are a lot of hot topics that are out there right now, and it's important for the audit committee to be aware of those. So for example, is everyone familiar with IFRS? So if you're a public company, you're probably going to do it, and if you're non-public, it's still probably going to happen down the road. But it's not a matter of just implementing that. The audit committee should be asking, for example, what are the processes you have in place? Because if you adopt that, you have to change your accounting systems. So there's all different things like that that they don't think about. The typical question I get from an audit committee is there anything out there I should worry about? But it's very hard for me as an auditor to say, what is it that you worry about? Everyone has different risk tolerance. Everyone has, you know, one person said to me, is there anything that will put me on the cover of the Globe? And he said, if it won't be on the cover of the Globe, then I really don't care about it. Well, that's not an appropriate answer either. So I think it's really asking the auditors, where do you see the risk? You could ask them those questions. The auditors will generally want to be helpful. They're not trying to hide anything. They just don't know how much information you want. We go through these presentations, and there's just a lot of stuff in there. And so we don't know what exactly you want to hear. We don't know what it is. We explain the risks, but we don't know if we're doing too much, too little. But the audit committee should be asking any question. There's really no such thing as a poor question from an audit committee person. I mean, this is what you're getting paid to be on that committee for, and the risk associated with that. So some of the questions I would make sure I would ask was, where do you see the risk of the company? Where do you see the potential of internal control issues? Those are some of the questions. When you were doing your audit, what was your focus? Why? What should I be concerned about? All those type of questions are important questions. The book will cover some of those in more detail. But if it's something that we see in EQA, we would be happy to do something on audit committee effectiveness.
You know, there's often a real disconnect between the pace of accounting changes that are going on in the profession and someone who is known as the financial expert, because oftentimes they're an ex-CEO, the current CEO. And it's just really hard to keep up with those differences for them.
So, absolutely.
That's what's on even the CFO. Keep them aware of that sort of
stuff. So what I recommend is, if you're on an audit committee, one of the things I always do is that every audit committee meeting, I go over technical issues, and I don't go over in depth. I just say, here are some highlights, just some bullet points for each of the issues that are coming out, proposed issues coming out, so this way they have a heads up. And they're aware of those issues when they're coming up. So for example, in the current year, technology companies in particular got faced with new revenue recognition rules. So we discussed that a year and a half ago. And so when it was ready to be implemented, the audit committee was fully aware of it. Do they know all the intricacies of it? No, but they knew it was coming. They knew that they had to make sure there were proper systems in place. So they were asking management. They were asking management, are you communicating with the auditors to make sure you're all in agreement with what's going on here? So they took the control perspective to make sure that they did their governance perspective to make sure it was being done correctly. If you were to ask them, do they know the rule inside out? Absolutely not. But are they comfortable if management did the process they were supposed to? Yes. And so I think that's another way, is just asking the auditors. We give, at the end of all of ours, a technical update that's this thick, but I don't go through that whole thing. I just say, here are four or five of the ones that you need to really focus on. So that's really what I would recommend. And we also, if you, whatever firm you use, typically have new accounting developments. And depending on the firm, they go out weekly, they go out monthly. Using our firm as an example, we just send them out all the time, but at a minimum, there's one that's quarterly, and in that quarterly, it goes over everything. Very briefly, but it goes over everything. So from an audit committee perspective, you can look at this and say, okay, I don't know all the details, but here are some of the new pronouncements that are coming out. So if anyone wants to be added to the, like, any of our lists for something like that, I'd be more than happy to add you. Just let me know.
Jim, he said that they don't know what questions to ask. Do audit committee members even know what their role is?
I think for Jim's point, I mean, I'm a former partner with a big firm,
former CFO, became a CEO. So what Jim said is absolutely correct. I'm not on top of it because I don't live it, but because I chair an audit committee, then I go on the board and they look at my resume and I go, hey, you're on the audit committee. You're now elected. So.
And there are people who really don't want to serve on the audit committee for that exact reason, is because they don't understand what their responsibility is and the risk that's associated with it. So they decline it.
I think I understand the risks and what the job is, but it's keeping up on the accounting pronouncements and so forth. It's,
I recommend, like I said, for example, from our perspective, that quarterly update, it's probably 20 pages and it has all the pronouncements in there that are new, and each one just covers like two paragraphs. So this way you just get a highlight and it tells you where to go for more information. It's just technical update. Yeah. So we also have... Yeah, and I would ask whoever the auditors are, when you're meeting with us, tell us some of the technical issues coming up. So, for example, I was going to say, for example, right now, at my most recent audit committee meeting, there's a thing called lease accounting, which is a lot of the leases are not on the books. Well, in the next year or two, they're all going to be on the books, potentially. So, is this going to affect them this year? No, but I wanted them to start thinking about how this is going to affect them, because now all this stuff that is off balance sheet will be on balance sheet. How is that going to affect their debt to equity? How is that going to affect their P&L? Yep, their EBITDA, all that type of stuff. And so it wouldn't be really good for me to go up to them the day it's about to be implemented and say, have you thought about this? And by then it's too late to do any structuring. So again, this is probably 2 years down the road, but they got them to think about it.
But in that situation, I would hope as an audit partner, your terms to the audit committee and say your CFO is not fulfilling his responsibilities without co-formering some of these changes for your company. I mean, I'm sure it happens a lot, but I've never seen, you know, that sort of disaster occur, the train coming off the tracks.
It depends. That, especially in today's environment, a lot of people have let go a lot of talent, and therefore they're short, and it's not that they're doing it on purpose. So I could tell you we've taken over accounts where there have been mistakes, and you ask where was the order. Well, the order tried bringing it up, and the company wasn't aware of it. They didn't think about it. They were ignoring it, all this other stuff. And so, and their responses were short staff. I mean, there's just been a lot of cutbacks by companies at this point. And so the talent that's in the company, let's say it was 10 people, now it's 6 people. And so now they have to do a lot more jobs, and they can't focus on trends and what's going on in the profession as far as new pronouncements and stuff. Hopefully you do have an audit partner or a CPA firm that will keep you up to date on those. But if they're not, you need to push them to do that.
you really need to.
You need to focus on what the key issues are driving your company. If you try to keep up with everything, you're probably going to get overwhelmed, but most of your footnotes to your financial statements, your 10K is going to talk about the key accounting issues. And as a director, you know, in the unfortunate event there's a problem and you're later subject to testimony about it, you're going to want to be able to explain that you understood what the key accounting principles, policies were, the decisions that were made, why they were made, and, you know, the CFO should help you, but you also have to ask questions of the auditor about what those are so that you can talk about it because you're signing these documents and you're expected to understand them.
Well, I'll give you an example where I don't think they fully understood, and this is probably 5 years ago where I was the partner who was auditing a company, and in their agreement, it said they had to keep a separate escrow account to fund the debt. And so we looked at it. We didn't see the escrow created. So we said, you're in violation. And they said, oh, it's a mere technical violation. Don't worry about this. So I said, get your legal counsel to tell me in a legal letter saying that they see that there was no basis that they could ever come after you, and then I'll talk to you. So the guy wrote in his own personal letterhead. The outside attorney wrote on his own personal letterhead, everything's okay, pretty much don't worry about it. I said, no, I want it on the firm, because the firm was a very reputable firm. So I want a firm letterhead. So they said they wouldn't do it. So then I said, okay, I brought it up to the audit committee. They dismissed it. The audit committee did not read the financial statements and did not read the opinion and did not listen to me as I was telling them the severity of this, that in essence, all the debt will be considered current, and they can call the debt and, in essence, bankrupt the company. So, and I talked about it in the audit committee meeting, but no one really was listening. That's exactly what happened. So the first thing they did was try to sue me because they said, you didn't tell us. And I said, well, here's my presentation. Here's the going concern opinion paragraph in the financial statements. Here's all the footnotes explaining it. Now, there, they didn't do their homework. They didn't want to hear what they were supposed to. And the company did go under. We came out clean because all the evidence was there of what we did. But that audit committee didn't truly understand how important it was for that.
Were they not, they clearly understood the compliance part, were they not monitoring it?
They were not monitoring it. And when I brought it up, they didn't view it as a big deal.
But it's a compliance violation?
Correct. They just, and I tried stressing to them, and they just thought I was out of my mind.
I have two questions. One is, I may be under the wrong impression, but if management slash board is disenchanted with the auditors, I've been under the impression that it's very hard to fire auditors. Yes or no, and is that a yes?
I know the answer is going to sound bad, but it depends, and I'll tell you why it depends. So, if you're a reputable company and you have a valid reason, you can change auditors. It will be very painful because of, if you're a public company, then you have to work with two firms for a couple of years. If you're a private company, it's not as bad. So if you're private, it's not nearly as bad as it is for a public. If you're a public company, when you have to deal with two auditors, it becomes an issue. Now, the other issue that scares people is when you go to a new firm, you don't know how they're going to look at your old accounting issues and will they agree or disagree. And I actually lost an account over this. That was a famous company where they wanted to go with us, and they said, Scott, we just want to make sure you're going to agree with the way we did our revenue. And as an auditor, by the way, in a proposal, I'm not allowed to answer that question. And so I said, look, I can't answer that question because under professional standards, that's opinion chopping, so I can't do it. I said, but what I can tell you is you have a reputable firm out there. I'm sure they went through their due diligence, and I am sure that based on that, there's probably a valid reasoning behind what they did. But I cannot, I just can't tell you with 100% certainty. So there's always that risk when you switch firms that sometimes expect. And by the way, if you're a firm that feels like that, that means probably you know that something is wrong with your accounting. If you're concerned about it, that means you probably know deep down that you did something wrong, probably. And so we didn't get to work because
revenue comes up a lot.
And, yes.
And it may be beyond disagreement. You can always disagree, but it can
I think sometimes the business proposition, understanding how the model works, and just saying, hey, we have just a polarized opinion about it, and I've seen some real brutal disagreements that get ugly, and sometimes get to this point about maybe it's time to change firms.
If you're looking, let's say you just don't agree with that, okay? And you can't go to another firm saying, well, you agree with us, because you can't do that. But I think you can open the door to discuss with another firm, as long as you give that open and candid conversation about what's going on. And literally, here's an example that literally just happened probably 4 years ago when I was in New Jersey. I was bidding on a company. It's the only time this has ever happened to me. They didn't tell me the whole story. The audit committee said, we just decided to leave. We just decided to leave the current firm, and we just wanted to change. Our requirement is to speak to the prior auditor before we can sign off. So literally, they were ready to file the 8K about 20 minutes from when I was just... I said, all I got to do is call up the former auditor, make sure everything's okay. Never in my history did I ever have a problem with that. I call up the prior auditor, and they say, we have severe disagreements with them. They don't cooperate. And we don't think you should take them on. They didn't come straight out to say that, but that's pretty much what they said. So I reject them. They're ready to file an 8K, and now they can't. They have to find another auditor. Now, this is a few years back. Ironically, 2 weeks ago, I was out to dinner with in-house counsel of that firm, and he told me the rest of the story, which I didn't hear, which was they were never mad at me. They were mad at the prior firm for doing that. But by the same token, the audit committee learned their lesson and said we need to be honest with the current firm, whichever firm we're going to go with, and tell them what exactly is going on. When they're open and honest with the communication, it's much easier for a new firm to look at that and say yes.
Well, you validated your work by saying it could be painful. Because, I didn't know whether I was under a wrong assumption or not.
My second question quickly is, any comments about the new legislation around whistleblowers and incentivizing employees?
We've seen a lot more activity in that, actually, where there's been a lot more whistleblowing and a lot more use of the in-house numbers. I've seen more coming to us directly now also, which puts us in an awkward situation at that point, so we have to notify the audit committee at that point. Those need to be taken very seriously, and we make sure they're taken seriously because we just don't know the integrity that's behind it at that point. So a lot, we have had clients where they don't want to take it seriously, and we have to push them, and we say you need to speak to a counsel to get advice on to what is going on here and make sure that you fulfill your fiduciary obligation at that point. And I don't know, maybe you can speak from the attorney perspective.
In a down economy, when there is a lot of attrition or risks, I see more whistleblower. So I've seen quite a few people send a whistleblower letter to the audit committee after they've learned they're going to lose their job. And so then, you know, it's frustrating to the company because they think this person has been let go, well, sometimes for poor cause, sometimes for financial reasons, and now they have to spend additional resources to investigate a claim that they think in this context may not be serious. But my advice always is you've got to go ahead and go through the drill. The audit committee does have to investigate the claim. They don't always need to have counsel do all of that. There's a variety of ways you can do the investigation. But even when the context for the claim coming in is a bit suspect, and someone may be trying to hold on to their job or create some leverage for a negotiation. So I've seen an increase just because of the economy. And in general, because whistleblowing is becoming more accepted.
Is that because of the legislation? Is that what you're saying?
Right. I saw already in my line of work doing accounting and securities litigation generally, there was already a fair amount of whistleblower activity, and it's gone up or down, driven by the economy. I mean, some of my partners who do healthcare fraud or other kinds of contexts in which whistleblowing would come up. The new legislation will create more opportunities for more different classes of whistleblowers. But there was already, companies were already expected to have a hotline. The audit committee was already expected to respond to whistleblowers. They were already protected under Sarbanes-Oxley. So I just think culturally it's more accepted, and, we're in an environment right now where there's more of that going on.
So to give you an example, I had a client just now where they fired someone and the letter came saying we think there's this misappropriation of assets, expenditure is not valid. So they looked at it, the whole subsidiary was not material to them. It would be impossible for any material amount. So they did their own research on it. They said that they did low bidding on contracts to win the work, or their gross profit was actually higher than any other stuff. So they looked at it, and they made the determination, and they documented all this, that they don't need to go out for further because it was just too small at that point. So I think it all depends on the situation. But, you know, just going back to what you're saying about the painful part of switching firms, I would also say if a firm isn't fitting the role, you do need to make a switch potentially. So it's that short-term pain, but the long-term pays off. So I think you need to balance both and look at it from that perspective. I think you need to look at it from both perspectives.
There's been a fair amount written about how you can the change can be good, your audit fees can be less, you can have a better relationship, your compliance can be higher. This is an environment right now where there's a lot more competition
in
the work, and I think there's an opportunity in changing.
Absolutely. I mean, unfortunately for us, the pricing of services and CPA firms has come under a lot of pressure over the last few years. So the only thing I would say about that is just make sure you're not hiring a firm that just short-term is lowering your price, and then once the economy turns around, it's just going to try to boost up that price also. I mean,
negotiation, you make an agreement. One of what the hourly rate is, and context around the hours based on the size, so you can control it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But you just need to monitor it and make sure from that perspective. So what other hot topics are you seeing from the audit committee perspective?
What I'm finding is, in new situations, the management of smaller companies, and particularly nonprofits, can't get used to the idea that the auditors don't report to them. And there's a degree of consternation about that.
It's a fine line for it puts the auditors in a difficult situation, like I was saying, because management pays our fees, although the audit committee technically pays our fees. But if management says we want to switch, a lot of times the audit committee would just go along with it. I'm not saying that's right, because I don't think it is right. We've seen situations where the audit committee never even meets the new firm, public companies, where they just leave it to management and they don't even meet, and we really find that unacceptable, because that immediately sends us that they don't care about the governance perspective from the audit committee. If they're not willing to meet with us or to even have a discussion, that's just showing it's just poor governance from that perspective. So it is a fine line of what you do with management versus the audit committee. Now, I will tell you, I will never not tell the audit committee something just because management says not to. And there are sometimes it's difficult, but I always at least give management the heads up. I want to give you the heads up. Here's what I'm going to say to management, to the audit committee. Give you time to prepare a response to it, or let's work together to come out with what's the best way to deal with this issue. So using a good example of this was when I first came up here, one of my first clients was right when the economy tanked, and we were doing what we call quarterly review, which was a September 30 quarter. And I said, you really need to look at your inventory reserves because your sales went down, and now you could have issues that you might not be able to sell all your inventory. Well, there was a major adjustment that came out of that. And so I said, well, now we have an issue from an internal control perspective because you didn't identify it, I identified. Now, I'm brand new to the job. I just moved up from Boston. And I said, you have a weakness here that we need to disclose to the audit committee. So they tried telling me, no, you can't do that, you can't do that. I said, I have an obligation to. I can't. I said, we can work together on how to give the message, but we still need to give that message. So we gave the message. Management came back with, well, here's how we're going to respond to it, and it was much more proactive. If you could work with management to deal with the audit committee, it's always much better than putting one against the other. And there are times the audit committee sometimes does that, where instead of being objective, a lot of times they just want to take management's side, so which is sometimes going against their fiduciary obligation. So they'll be saying, well, I don't think that's a big deal. Why do you have to disclose that? Why do you have to disclose that internal control weakness? Well, it's for their protection also. They have an obligation to do this. So they're not working for management. They are supposed to be objective.
Well, that's the biggest downside of South Amazon. All the night, the relationship, this is from management's perspective, went from one of cooperation to one of adversary.
You talking about with the auditor? Or?
It became an adversarial relationship because, particularly at the beginning of Sarbanes-Oxley, that, you know, the boundaries really weren't defined. And that is such as an auditor coming in. I mean, in the old days, if the auditor came in and made that recommendation, that was not considered a weakness of control.
Yeah.
Not a reportable event. And you could go to the audit committee and tell them what you, which is fine. But having them, you know, having it as a material weakness or a whatever weakness it is kind of silly and didn't.
Oh, and I agree, and I think there are firms who took it to the extreme when it first came out. But I think there's a healthy balance. I think most firms at this point know what those boundaries are. And I was just on a call today, and the company's trying to do something, and we were trying to help them guide them through it to make sure that then they know all from. They haven't signed the deal, but they understand the ramifications of each thing that they do from the deal. So. You know, here's another example of a poor audit committee effectiveness, which was it was a telecom company, so this was back like early 2000s, where we were in the audit committee meeting, and they were trying to push on us an accounting revenue recognition that was just completely wrong. And so they said to us, "You don't know what you're talking about. You're completely out of reality. And therefore, we think we need to switch firms." And my response was, if you can show us other firms the evidence that they support your position, I'll be more than happy to look at it again. I said, but unless you can show me that, here's our position, here's why we support our position. And they were beating us up, and we walked out terrible. And then the next day, the CFO called me up and said, well, they tried. I said, what do you mean they tried? He goes, well, we were hoping that we can convince you to do it, but we had no basis for it. And you know, here I am, so sometimes sometimes you have to hold your ground, and hopefully it pays off. In two instances, if I didn't hold my ground, for example, in that one where they didn't hold that escrow, our firm would have been sued. Mm-hmm. Our firm would have easily been sued.
But I'm confused. Because didn't you say earlier that you couldn't render an opinion coming in as a potential new audit firm? And so in this case that you just mentioned, you were challenging them to go out and find an audit firm that would...
We were the current auditors.
Pardon?
We were the current auditors, and they were saying they disagreed with...
Right, you said go out and find some other auditors that
would... You could actually... You could get a second opinion. You could. But you can't do it as part of trying to find the new work. So
another firm won't give the opinion because that automatically takes them out of the audit.
It makes it very tough.
Since it's an oligopoly.
It makes it tough. So, but there are firms. So, for example, and it's very common actually, is when the company doesn't have the proper resources, they will use other firms to help them come up with that guidance. So, it's not that it's opinion shopping at that point. It's more to supplement the staff of the accounting department. So, so that's not opinion shopping. So, if they're not going and say, if they're supplementing. If they're looking for that guidance, it's not opinion shopping because they're not looking for that firm to give them their audit opinion at that point. So if they're saying, we want you to be our auditors, but tell me in advance that you're going to be okay with, that's no good. But if we're the current auditors, for example, and someone says, we need your help with revenue recognition, another firm can help out. Now, if they switch to them, that becomes a whole separate issue then, because then you have disclosures if you're a public company that you have to do and stuff like that.
Could you touch upon the trends you see with audit committees in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act? I'm a former public company CFO, and then I became a general manager running a network of independent distributors in the emerging markets. And I was a little shocked at the lack of a true compliance testing of, you know, such an important law, especially when you're in the emerging market.
So, ironically, I just... Tuesday, we had an audit committee meeting, and I brought my FCPA specialist We just acquired an R firm, Euron Consulting, a division of theirs that specializes in fraud, forensics, disputes, all that type of stuff. And so I had them come to discuss the FCPA with my current audit committee of one of my clients. And it is shocking because if you're going into different countries, what you consider a valid payment really could be problems. And they did a great job explaining it, and I didn't even realize this. So, for example, if you're giving a payment to a doctor, they were saying, and that doctor works for a hospital that is government affiliated, you've just now all of a sudden violated the act. So there's all intricacies of that law that you have to really affect, and I don't think people truly understand it. I'd be happy if people want the presentation I gave that we gave out to my audit committee there to get that and to send it out to people. If you want, just email me. I'd be more than happy to try to get you something on that. It is definitely an issue, especially as you go internationally, to think about what are the controls you have in place over that, because all those payments that you think are valid payments might be considered bribes and stuff like that.
It's another whole sort of sideband investment for a company, because you have to annually certify that they're in compliance, and it gets pretty expensive trying to verify who you are in some of the companies.
And some of them that you think are bribes are actually not even bribes.
No.
So it goes both ways. Some things that you would never be, that you think are not bribes are bribes, and some things that you would think are bribes are not considered bribes. So it goes both ways. So I think you need to... I'm not an attorney, and so I don't know what...
It's a hot area. I think a lot of our cases that are revenue recognition or some other issue, plaintiffs' lawyers are looking to see if they can find, if they can find a violation, because it dramatically changes the case from a judgment call about different ways you could approach a transaction to something seedy.
Right.
And it's pretty hard. It's very expensive to be in compliance and pretty hard and pretty hard to control. It's also the government is very active in this area. So...
And
depends on how risk-averse you are, but I would say the likelihood of someone looking at it is pretty high.
And I wrote notes because when I was there, so, and maybe you're aware of this, the UK is coming out with a broad, you want to just discuss that a second?
I'm not an expert in it. There's a couple of partners that do, but Europe has become much more aggressive, and the UK has just come out with a new standard. And all I know about it, sorry, I certainly couldn't teach you about it, but I could connect you with some of it, but it's going to be even more difficult to comply with than what the current rules are in the U.S.
Yeah, it's harsher than the U.S. and much more broad, so it would be...
The fines are very extreme.
And by the way, for the FCPA, I think it's for that, but at least for this new UK one, at least for sure, if you're a citizen and you're doing it in another country, you don't have to be in that. It's if you're a citizen, you're affected by it. So... There's some significant ramifications to this, and I talked to my audit committee about this, saying that they need to, and I think it scared them a little. Mm-hmm. Now, management didn't seem in the least concerned about it. It's a serious issue, and to make sure you have the proper internal controls in place to make sure that those payments are actually, and you have to have the books and records to support it and stuff. It's not just... You have to have full support for what you're doing from that perspective.
How typical is it that you've seen a public board, the CEO and the chairman of the board on the audit committee?
I would tell you in today's environment, I don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
I would say 8 to 10 years ago, I saw it. Now, I don't see it.
I would raise a red flag.
Yeah.
Why would it raise a red flag for you?
Because I really, in all my cases, I want the audit committee to be independent. It's much easier to defend their behavior. And if management is on the audit committee, it's much harder for me to defend their work, legitimately or not, on the merits. I mean, I am a big advocate for going through governance, going through your paperwork, making a record of what you've done. It just makes it easier for me to defend it later. So, I mean, the audit committee should be in dialogue with the CEO and the CFO a lot. They should meet with them a lot and understand the financial statements. But to have them be on the audit committee, I think you have to have a large audit committee to make that work, because you have to have X number of independent directors on your audit committee for most exchanges listing standards. So it would just, for me, it would just raise a red flag, and this would mean my job would be harder. It doesn't mean it's impossible, but it just would make it, I think the SEC would look fun at it too.
How about the chairman of the board?
If the chairman of the board is an independent director.
That would be a problem. In fact, that would be a very engaged chairman. He or she wants to both be chairman and be on the audit committee.
But I'll use two examples, two issues. One is, in a private company, a lot of times the board is friends of the CEO, and so you have, in theory, that independent audit committee that is not independent whatsoever because they're all friends of the CEO, and if you say something bad to them, it's going back to the CEO, and therefore you don't have that independence. The other thing I would say is, from a public company perspective, if the CEO attends those meetings, even if they're not part of the audit committee and they attend those, it's not a healthy dialogue then between the auditors and the audit committee at that point. Really, it should just be the audit committee, the CFO for a part of that time to explain stuff, but after that, they leave and there's a private session. That's the other thing I would say is that private session, I would say 50% of the time, they don't ask for. And they should always ask for that because there could be something that you want to tell them that you can't say in front of management as an auditor. So if they don't ask it, you should always ask, even if there's nothing to discuss, even if it's a 30-second meeting, is there anything you need to tell us that we haven't heard when you were presenting with the CFO? Those meetings are really important. Again, not every single time are they going to do something, but there are times you're like screaming, can we meet privately? And they're saying, okay, we're done. And you don't have that opportunity to do it. So what other topics? I can read you some of the stuff that I came up with that could be some topics that are important. Understanding the risk of the cost reductions. So with cost reductions, we talked about this a little, when you reduce headcount in the financial group, you need to really ask management, how are you dealing with your financials? We've seen a slowdown in being able to get financials, sloppiness in the financials now. Again, not that these people aren't qualified, they're just overburdened with work, and that will affect. We actually had a company where a press release went out with all bad numbers. And We said to them, you can't do it because we haven't been able to prove those numbers. They issued it, and then when they issued their 10Q, they had to redo their numbers. So you need to understand, and it's not that they wouldn't have caught those, but they were so in a hurry to get that press release out that no one understood that they were just overwhelmed and that they just put in the wrong numbers. Focus on all financial communications. So, for example, press releases. The SEC is all over this stuff. They're looking at, are your press releases matching what you're saying in your 10-K, what's in your proxy, what's going on Twitter, what's going on all this stuff, and is everything linked together, and is it making sense, and are there any contradictions out there? So, on the audit committee, you should be asking, what is the company's internal controls to make sure that all this stuff is working properly, and that there's proper controls, and that governance over this type of stuff, and that you're seeing the stuff before it goes out. Has anyone ever experienced any issues with that? Just out of curiosity. So my example of the press release was just in the last 6 months, actually.
Not that, but the burden on the finance function and the sloppiness delivering stuff to the auditors late is clearly there.
And management will push, and this is where the audit committee is really important. So management will push to say, I don't care. We gave it to you 3 weeks late. We still want it done the same time. And the audit committee needs to push back on management and say, you know what? You need to make sure you have a high-quality product. And you know what? You gave it to the auditors 3 weeks late. You can't expect the same time frame. Now, that's good governance. Bad governance would be, I don't care, you got it 3 weeks late, just get it out the door. And we've seen that. And we've seen where the audit committee just is pro-management and not really thinking about what their risk is. Their risk is if that goes out wrong, they have a restatement, they're in litigation. But sometimes they don't think about that. They just view themselves sometimes as the advocate of management.
Well, just with anything happening internally or externally, there's a communications component to all of that. It's not just the press release. How is it being communicated internally and externally according to this audience? What do our employees, our vendors, our customers, what do they think about it?
And it's important that everyone be on the same page and be communicating the same message. It doesn't happen.
So, ERM, Enterprise Risk Management, is a big issue, and the big debate is who's responsible for that.
Have you seen audit committees being assigned that?
So, I did some research to try, and I don't know where I came up with this, so I'll say this is unaudited from my perspective. But what I found was in one study, and I don't know who did it, 60%, when they look at the committees on the board who are responsible, 60% said it was the audit committee, and 17% said it was the executive committee. And the rest were all different. Some of them had their own risk committees and stuff. But ERM is a really hot topic, and we have some stuff over there on it. And actually, I'll give this out. This is just a highlight. Okay. This is just to give you an example of some of the things to think about from an enterprise risk management perspective. And so it's not just internal control. It's what do you do if you lose your key customer? What happens if your data gets, if there's data interruption? All these ERM issues that people are not thinking about. And I think audit committee is strong to ask, are they responsible for this? And I think the answer is no one really knows from what I can tell until the board decides who's ultimately responsible. I don't know what you've seen in practice.
I've seen a lot of people saying the audit committee is responsible. To me, that doesn't seem realistic. I'd like to see it spread around, you know, or different assignments made, and other people on the board having the kind of work that the audit committee already has. But I would say, for the most part, and it may be that the people on the audit committee are seen as the people that will really get in, dig in, and do this work, but at most companies I've seen are pushing this to the audit committee. Somewhat reflexively, I don't think that's a thoughtful resolution.
And I can tell you, just from what I've seen, the audit committee does not feel qualified to deal with this. In any way, so if they didn't know the financial, this is even taking it a step further, I think, in that they just are not aware of this. So they're just not at that level to do it, and they don't truly understand this. And it's a serious issue at this point that companies are trying to deal with at this point, is this enterprise risk management. So that we saw as a hot topic. And then the last thing I would say is just evaluating the audit committee, which is, how are they doing? A lot of times what they'll do is they'll take out the charter and they'll say, did we do everything we were supposed to? And the answer to that is yes, but to me that doesn't make it an effective audit committee. It's just like checking the boxes. It's not, did you ask the probing questions? Did each member contribute? And so there should be a way to really evaluate, there should be a mechanism in place that there really is an objective evaluation of each audit committee member. And in that book, actually, there's some examples of that.
I never thought about it. Have you ever gotten involved as the auditor?
No, we can't get involved with that. Although we do have, ironically, we do have to evaluate the audit committee effectiveness as part of our SOX testing from a governance perspective. But we don't share that. But I will tell you, if we don't see an effective audit committee, we turn down engagements. So, as an example, a prospect wanted to come to us. They had some material weaknesses, which are in the internal controls that they really never fixed, and that set a tone for us that they really didn't seem to care about the risk associated with misstated financial statements. And so we turned it down. And they were like, why would you turn us down? We said, we don't see the governance perspective really taking hold here. And so that does happen. So it can happen that the auditors turn down companies when they don't see that type of good corporate governance.
We have to stop now. You were talking about board of committee evaluations. Next month, Marianne Ebert is going to come in.
Look at that segue. Look at that.
Thank you very much.
Do I shut this?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just... I'm the media specialist.
So do I need